As usual, really, really nice to be back. I want to tell you about some ideas that came out of work with Thomas Kreutzig and Wenjun on boundary vertex algebras and Kashan-Lustig correspondences. We were trying to sort of simplify some rather complicated results on categories of modules for boundary VOAs in 3D n equals 4 theories. And then realized that we potentially could do it quite effectively. And now I'm realizing maybe some of this was known all along. But I'll show you some pretty pictures and hopefully tell you part of a beautiful story that at least adds some perspective. So to set the stage, in basic setup, in physics, say in the simplest sorts of quantum field theories, if we have something topological, local operators have the structures of algebras, and algebras are relatively simple things to describe. They're vector spaces, so you like give a basis, and then you say what the product is on basis elements, and that's a thing you can teach to undergraduate physicists. But then, if you try to describe line operators, suddenly those, like the full sort of mathematical incarnation of those is categories. Now the data becomes much more complicated. You don't, especially if the category isn't semi-simple, you don't exactly have a basis. And you need some good way to organize the information there. And it gets sort of more, well, let me say, like physically the issue is that the objects of these categories are the lines, but the lines may have bound states that are non-trivial, and they may have more and more and more complicated bound states. And then in addition to these crazy bound states of line operators, there are local operators at junctions that also all need to get described, and that ends up being a whole lot of data. So how to organize it? One answer to that is to try to represent the category as modules for some simpler algebra. And when that's possible, that's a very effective way to take something very complicated and repackage it. And that sort of philosophy, when it works, is and it ought to work, is quite effective going to say surface operators and higher dimensional things. It sort of iterates. So surface operators have the structure of two categories, but those ideally could effectively be described as representations of some category with a product and so on. Anyway, so an optimistic way to organize the structure that's there physically, that is mathematically around in higher categories, is by sort of representing the categories. We see this in, like, if you actually ask a physics undergrad, like what are line operators, they might not say that they're very complicated. Like, ah, they're Wilson lines. I know about Wilson lines. And that's actually an example of this sort of thing. So yes, indeed, in a gauge theory with gauge group G, part of the category of line operators does look like representations of G. Or another way to say that is representations of the enveloping algebra of little g that are integrable. But it's somehow not the full answer. It's correct if you engineer your situation properly. It's the correct answer, say, in 4DBF theory.
You can integrate B along a line, can't you?
No, that would give you surfaces. As I was writing this, I'm like, is there any theory where that's actually the right answer? So it's RepG is sort of sitting there in some familiar, maybe to part of the audience, theories. In 4D n equals 4 Young Mills, in one of the geometric Langlands twists, RepG is certainly there. But it's sitting in some much fancier derived category here that's involved in the derived geometric Satake equivalents. Also in 3D Trin-Simons theory, RepG is sort of there at infinite level, but at finite level, the correct answer is modules for a quantum group. Okay, so... right, some of you are probably like screaming inside that I'm telling you naive things and there are good answers to the questions I'm posing. I'm being dumb. So there are good mathematical answers for how to make all of this more precise. If someone throws a category at you mathematically, and you want to represent it as modules for something, there's a thing called the Tanakian formalism that gives you a roadmap for how to do that. Tanakian duality tells you to try to do the following, and under certain assumptions, it'll actually work. Try to construct a functor from your category C. To the category of vector spaces. And if your category happens to be monoidal, say it has a tensor product, your functor had better respect that tensor product. Or if it's braided, it had better respect that braiding, where the braiding in vector spaces is trivial. And so these functors to vector called fiber functors, then construct... if C is actually a category, you'll construct an algebra as the symmetries of F. And if it's a higher category, it'll be some higher analog of an algebra. And then, with good assumptions, your original category gets represented as modules for that symmetry algebra of the fiber function. That's the math answer. And that brings us back now to the physics problem. How do you actually get a fiber functor? What do its symmetries mean? A rough answer to that is that fiber functors come from boundary conditions, either at finite distance or at infinity. And that symmetry algebras of fiber functors come from operators or excitations of these boundary conditions. That's a lot of that was known, and that's also part of what I'd like to explore. So, as I said, a lot of this has been known in various guises, and like the more I think about this whole project, the more I realize that many, if not all, the pieces were like sort of all around in the last 20 years of work. Manifestations of this sort of like representing categories in physics by using symmetries of fiber functors idea are all present, at least in retrospect, are all present in things people were doing. I don't know if anyone was remembers this, or I was like, wait a minute, am I the only one who actually thought when I was in grad school, I ended up playing with quivers, representing categories of brains in string compactifications. And that came from a lot of work in the late 90s and early 2000s, Douglas and Moore and others trying to explain why brains were related to quivers, and all of that is sort of I won't go on forever, but is a manifestation of this sort of Tanakhian principle. Part of exactly how that is a manifestation of that principle is explained nicely in some recent work of Dylan Butson and Miroslav Rabchak. So somewhat more recently, a lot of the work of Kevin and collaborators on holomorphic twists and Jungians and Jungian-like algebras, and more generally on causal duality and holography, is a manifestation of these ideas. In particular, the causal duality and holography program, I sort of see, if I'm allowed to sort of see the program as a manifestation of Tanakhian duality in a perturbative context. If you apply Tanakhian principles to a QFT defined not just perturbatively but in a DG way in BV formalism, and follow one's nose cleverly. And use a vacuum at infinity to get yourself a fiber functor. But the more I look, the more I see manifestations of all of this. So I was reminded recently that there's this highly overlooked paper of Witten's. After the Kapustin-Witten paper on geometric Langlands, he wrote a paper on just by himself called Geometric Langlands and the Equations of Nam and Bogomoni, in which he gives a physical interpretation of the fiber functor for the Satake correspondence using something very, very similar to what I'll discuss today. And I think if I had paid attention, then I could have drawn the same pictures I'm drawing today. He uses pairs of transverse boundary conditions. Okay, so right. The point of this is Tanakhian duality is everywhere. What I actually want to describe today is a particular implementation of Tanakhian duality that is non-perturbative, that uses not a vacuum at infinity, but a pair of transverse boundary conditions at finite distance. And I'll do everything in a 3D context for lack of time and for lack of space in drawing pictures. But it should be at least morally clear how it all generalizes. The motivation, again, was in 3D. It was trying to find quantum groups that govern categories of lines and twists of 3D n equals 4 theories. The particular ideas that led me to the constructions today were really inspired by some work of Nana Amand, so she's a PhD student who just finished in Denmark, but worked. She's a PSI student who worked closely with Kevin, and described how quantum groups arrive perturbatively in transimens, and a lot of the computations she does involve a pair of transverse boundary conditions. And I wanted to know why is that so important? And there's a good reason. I'll explain the reason today. I've realized there's some ongoing work of Theo's and David Reuter's on higher linking and braiding that is also very, very similar to all this. And so this may end up having a great deal of overlap with what they're doing. Right. So my goal now is going to be to extract. What I want to do is to analyze line operators in 3D QFT, and I'm going to draw some pictures to extract Hopf algebras and quasi-triangular Hopf algebras that govern them. I want to set up some assumptions. So I'll assume that I have, and I'll put the strongest possible assumptions on for now. I have an oriented 3D topological quantum field theory, and we'll build fiber functors using a pair of boundary conditions that are transverse to each other in the sense that their sandwich collision is trivial. And I call them DNN because the classic example of this is Dirichlet and Neumann in a gauge theory. And so at the end, I hope to get to some examples. And one of the very simple examples is Dyck-Raff-Witten theory, finite group gauge theory, where all of this is very concrete. Literally, Dirichlet-Neumann. A slightly stronger version of transversality that I will actually use is local. So not just colliding them gives a trivial two-dimensional theory, but I do want to know that I can collide little local neighborhoods of them and have them annihilate. And the little tubes. And then you can ask about the opposite collision. What if you put them back to back the other way? Well, that is almost certainly not trivial. But what you can ask for is a deformation of the stacking back to back the other way. That's equivalent to the trivial interface in the original QFT. And I'm calling that a completeness condition. Depending on what sort of TQFT we're working in, this sort of deformation will either be described, like in the DG, perturbative DG setting, it's a more Cartan element that deforms that's local, that deforms the operator algebra on the product. In something like Dyker-Flitton theory, it's a condensation. It's some web of operators that's added to the product, so that the stacking is equivalent to the trivial interface. And that's certainly possible. Let me say it in words. In gauge theory, if you have Neumann on one side and Dirichlet on the other, and try to glue them, Dirichlet has a global G symmetry, and you just use the gauge symmetry on Neumann to gauge the global symmetry on Dirichlet to glue the theory back together. So in this completeness thing just means you can glue the theory back together. There's enough information around. Cool. So, if we have a bulk theory and two boundary conditions, there are actually three categories around. There's a category of lines in the bulk, and there are categories of lines on each boundary condition. The categories of lines on the boundaries are monoidal, where tensor product comes from, collision of lines parallel to each other along the boundaries. And in addition, the category of lines in the middle is braided. One expects, and I imagine one can prove using the completeness condition on the previous slide, that the Drinfeld centers of either, I think we can probably prove using the next few slides, that the Drinfeld centers of either of the boundary categories is the bulk category. I should say that there's sort of a, in math TQFT, when one defines like an extended 3D TQFT, it's typically like defined from the boundary inwards. And so you never ask the question, like, is the Drinfeld center of the boundary category the same as the bulk category? That's not something that comes up.
That's the definition.
But in physics, it is something that comes up. You want to make sure you sort of start with the bulk, and then you want to construct a boundary condition that's sensitive enough to measure everything that was in the bulk, and it may or may not be true. That's the sort of thing I'm worrying about. Okay. So then we get, yeah.
It does kind of come up. I mean, like, that's like why people know things like when they start talking about like, oh, you need 2 co or whatever, all this nonsense. You can like measure that failure with this sort of thing.
If you want a generator, then you can.
Yeah, you'll find like something enough. Or, I mean, but it's heuristic. But it's for the same exact reason you're going to get.
It's a community dependent statement. There's a community. If you ask someone who works on like Touré-Vira theories, like what is a Touré-Vira theory, they will tell you it's a spherical fusion of two category. And that is a boundary inwards, and you're using boundary conditions to define the bulk. And that's a perspective that's very often taken. I agree. We should use all perspectives and translate back and forth and learn things. Given this wealth of information, we have more than enough to construct fiber functors for all the categories around. Fiber functors for boundary lines are constructed by capping lines on one boundary condition with a half cylinder of the opposite boundary. So the pictures that are most useful for me are at the top, sort of on the left and right. But if those pictures don't make sense, another way to say it is that for every object in, say, lines on the boundary condition N, we will form a vector space. And it's the vector space of states on a half disk, with this configuration of decorations on the boundary of the half disk. And similarly for D, and in the bulk, we do the symmetric thing. So we can take a bulk line and surround it with half D and half N, and produce a vector space that way of states on the actual disk with the bulk line in the middle. The reason I needed to use two boundary conditions and not one was to get these functors to be monoidal. Without two transverse boundary conditions, there's no guarantee that the vector space I associate to two line operators next to each other will be the tensor product of vector spaces associated to each one independently. Transversality is what lets me, take a half cylinder with two line operators next to each other and split it into two independent half cylinders, and hence get the tensor product of vector spaces. The transversality is crucial for getting fiber functors. For getting monoidal functors. So then we try to apply Tanakhian philosophy and ask, what physically, now we have very concrete pictures for the fiber functors, what are their symmetries? What are their endomorphisms, and how do we get algebras out? Well, for the fiber functor for lines on Neumann, or N, symmetries come from any operators supported sort of in the complement of the vertical red line on Neumann. So they'll come from operators that are supported on the horizontal green arc here. And arc algebras already mean something very different in mathematics. And chord algebras also mean something very different in mathematics. And so I've been calling what you get from local operators stretched on one of these arcs spark algebras. I sort of think of them as like electrical sparks stretched between a pair of wires that can sort of move up and down. And they move up and down in a way that never touches the red line. So there are a few other pictures of what the spark algebra is. So if we flatten out this boundary, it's got the bulk theory on the inside. So the spark algebra is they're operators supported on an interval, on a little strip of D. Or by state operator correspondence, just the underlying vector space of the spark algebra is the space of states on a rectangle. And now we can do that for get the spark algebra on Dirichlet, we've got the Spark algebra on Neumann, and we've got sparks relevant for the bulk, which end up looking like states on an annulus. And kind of a beautiful thing that appears very quickly in the state operator correspondence is that the Neumann and Dirichlet sparks, at least if everything is finite dimensional, are canonically dual to each other. These two state spaces are dual. Just rotate one of the rectangles by 90 degrees. So then we prove a bunch of things. At this point, at a heuristic physics level, I say that because there is like rigorous 3D TQFT, extended TQFT formalism that could also be applied to the setting that I'm not so far trying to use. So claims, the two boundary spark algebras are actually Hopf algebras. I'll explain why, but then in trying to look if like anyone else had done something like this, I actually found a beautiful set of slides of David Reuter's from a talk he gave here 5 years ago, where it's a talk about like geometrization of Hopf algebras in higher extended TQFT, where he actually proves exactly this. He says, suppose you have a 3D TQFT with two boundary conditions and consider the state space on a rectangle. And he proves that thing is a Hopf algebra.
But I mean, in the perturbative case, this is exactly the causal dual. Because how do I define the causal dual of an E2 algebra? I take factorization homology along an integral, augmentation on either end.
Thank you.
But of course, that's general, because you are not assuming.
Oh, thank you.
Generated by the identity line. This is exactly the cardinal, and then this is this old theorem of Tamarkin that the cardinal dual of an E2 algebra is a Hopf algebra.
No, that's great. So. Yeah, I was going to make some comments about Clausel duality, but that I had not realized that connection.
The formula for Clausel duality is an X or two work, which is this line stretch between two things.
Awesome. So I'll explain in pictures why the two spark algebras are Hopf algebras. And they're canonic, at least if everything is finite dimensional, they're canonically dual, but more so, they have a Hopf pairing. And in pictures, the Hopf pairing is given by considering the partition function on a three ball. With northern and southern hemisphere colored by different boundary conditions, and one spark stretched in the north and the other spark stretched in the south. That gives a number. And being a Hopf pairing means that multiplication on one side is actually dual to co-multiplication on the other side. That's formula is trying to say. Moreover, the spark algebra in the middle is intrinsically quasi-triangular. It has a geometrically defined R matrix, and that R matrix agrees with what one gets algebraically from this classic quantum double construction. Using the fact that we have two Hopf paired Hopf algebras. That's the information one needs for Dornfeld's quantum double. And finally, there's an equivalence of categories that gets us the representations we need. Perturbatively, the bit that I've thought about so far in a, at least what I've managed to understand so far in a DG setting, if one sets this up the way that Kevin and Natalie analyze line operators and asks, you know, suppose line operators are obtained by starting with a trivial line, coupling in quantum mechanics, well, throwing in a vector space and deforming, coupling to quantum mechanics. And then obtaining mathematically that, that the category you get I feel like anything I'm about to say has already been said. Anyway, one does get that the spark algebras are the Clausel duals. Maybe I did understand the thing that you said.
So I think there's a right? Your formula for the spark algebra is the formula.
And that's the bit that I totally didn't. Yeah, that's what I didn't appreciate.
So the HD is
that's wonderful.
The linear dual, so you can do apply linear dual.
Yes.
And then because you've proved this duality between your statement forms, there's a model of your statement.
Yeah. There's an extra beautiful bit of consistency that there's a calculation that the Hopf pairing coming from the ball in the perturbative setting is actually given by the E3 bracket of bulk local operators, but then the R matrix is the inverse of the Hopf pairing. And that at least was the first concrete way I had of understanding why statements that Kevin had made to me a long time ago that the R matrix should be related to the E3 bracket. Okay. I want to throw some pictures at you for why things are true. Why do we get Hopf algebras? David Reuter's, it's slides of a talk, but they're like incredibly beautiful slides of a talk, but he does everything with rectangles. This is a reformulation of that in terms of sparks. Multiplication comes from stacking. It's product of operators vertically. Co-product comes from including one interval into two intervals. Then one has to go and check the axioms of a Hopf algebra. There's things like co-associativity of the co-product, which means if you apply the co-product twice, it doesn't actually matter in what order you do it. That's a topological manipulation. But also, the co-product needs to be an algebra homomorphism. So the co-product of AB has to be co-product of A times co-product of B. And that requires transversality of the two boundary conditions. Co-product of AB is the two sparks inserted into that sort of double pair of pants. And to separate that into coproduct of A times coproduct of B, you have to poke your finger through and cancel a pair of transverse boundary conditions to make a little hole. And then you can cut this into coproduct of A times coproduct of B. The way product and coproduct are set up, the fact that we get, so they end up automatically being compatible with tensor product of lines. Coproduct is automatically compatible with tensor product of lines on the opposite boundary. And so the fact that we get a tensor product from, say, lines on Neumann to modules for sparks on Dirichlet, and that comes for free. The fact that this is an equivalence requires completeness of the boundary conditions, that there's sort of big enough to detect everything. We've talked a bit about the Hopf pairing already. It has a really important property that we'll use to produce the bulk R matrix. And that's that it inverts what I'll call a box gluing. So if we try to glue two half space theories whose boundaries have a strip of Neumann on one side and a strip of Dirichlet on the other side, and we try to glue them in a square region. By assumption, we know that we can. There is some deformation of this that will allow us to glue across that square. That deformation has to be by operators supported in the square here and the square here, but those operators are sparks. And so it's going to be some sum of sparks here and sparks here. But whatever that is needs to be inverted by the Hopf pairing, essentially coming from the fact that if we glue a ball along a box, we can glue any spark into the strip. Writing this out into formulas, that gluing a ball into the spark gluing a ball into the strip just gives us the same thing with any spark attached. It just tells us that whatever combination of sparks was used here, the coefficients have to be the inverse of the Hopf pairing. And that's used to take us up to the bulk. So two cool things happen in the bulk. This is the last slide of crazy pictures. So the S1 spark algebra, I claimed was quasi-triangular. So it's a Hopf algebra in essentially the same way that the boundary ones were. But in addition, it's got an R matrix, because the coproduct now can be twisted around. The two, the two top circles in the bulk pair of pants can be moved around each other. And the R matrix can be defined by starting with just the coproduct of one, an empty double pair of pants, with the two top circles twisted. That's a thing that makes sense in the bulk.
I mean, I don't know why you're saying it in such a complicated way, right? I take a slab, a line in the bulk becomes a line in the trivial theory downstairs, it's vector space. I take two crossing lines, I get an endomorphism of that vector space of the Gore matrix.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem easier to describe?
But I want it as an element of an algebra.
But any representation.
But I can get it. I understand it's like maybe two epsilon more than what you just said, and it's dual to what you just said. I agree. If you try to define the R matrix purely topologically, as whatever you get from this sort of twisted cobordism, that twisted double pair of pants can be produced by taking two disconnected tubes and gluing them in a box. And the box gluing is a sum of sparks with coefficients that are the inverse of the Hopf pairing.
You want to match with the formula of the formula.
Yeah. And I see that as a topological proof that
so then the slab argument is going to be easy, but once you know that representations of your Hopf algebras are the same as lines, then you can cover the Hopf algebra just by inserting an arbitrary line. And then you have, you know, just crossing lines, that's the R matrix, and then you can bring them to the top and the bottom.
How do you compute it?
In concrete,
sorry. How do you know a priori that it's going to be the inverse of the Hopf pairing?
Because when you bring them to the top and the bottom, I suppose you have to prove that the pairing you get by putting a line at the top and a line at the bottom is the Hopf pairing.
And then you know that lines in the middle are the Dirichlet center, and you're using that.
So maybe there's something more on trivial.
Yeah. No, I so, sorry. No, I totally agree. I was looking for something direct.
Yeah.
The
pictures are easier if you just draw them crossing lines and drawings.
Yeah. And my point is that there's a way to get it with pure topology.
This is pure topology too, right? What's your objection? Slab quantification. That's a thing you can do in TFTs.
Because you need to know fancy things about Dirichlet centers. Yes. Which we do know, and yes. No, that's it. And the other, to me, highly non-trivial piece of a Dirichlet double, if we don't know about Dirichlet centers, the other non-trivial piece of a Dirichlet double in trying to form this S1 spark algebra from the two interval spark algebras, we need to know how to commute sparks on the two halves past each other. And there's a correction to that that comes from the endpoints of the sparks, and that correction can be factored off into two Hopf pairings. and leads to, again, this is just a, reformulation of well-known things that correction can be factored off. And do you have pairings and leads and anyway, and reinterprets a very, very well-known formula for the product in the Drinfeld double.
Sorry to keep interrupting, but
yeah.
So I would have thought you would also suppose I thought about this using both lines instead of battery lines. Wouldn't I have determined the ODT presentation of the Drinfeld double? You know what I mean?
Not well, no.
You should, because it's very similar. Because you have a universal law matrix, and the elements of your algebra satisfy a relation coming from the Young-Baxter equation, and that's a defining relation. Makes sense?
Makes sense and is not something I'm super familiar with.
It's
great.
It's kind of in the same world.
Yeah. Thanks. So let me give some examples and wrap up. Part of my point, but also like the discussions we're having now, there are lots of starting points you can choose to sort of recover the same information. And some may be more convenient depending on circumstance. I think learning and appreciating for the first time what formulas in this part of representation theory actually mean. This way. I find it useful if, like, I wanted to know things about 3D n equals 4 theories, and I was confronted with a situation where it was not clear exactly what I needed to compute to get some quantum group-like thing in the bulk. This perspective has really helped clarify that, but it's far from the only one. In the case of Dyagraph-Witten theory, which is a bit simpler, so this is gauge theory with finite group G. It always has a Dirichlet boundary condition that trivializes. It's theory of G bundles. The path integrals is sum over G bundles. The Dirichlet boundary condition trivializes the G bundles, chooses a trivialization. Neumann only exists if the three cocycle or Chern-Simons term is zero. You need to assume that. And it just lets G bundles fluctuate. The category of lines on Neumann is rep G. In physical terms, lines on Neumann are Wilson lines. So this is one of those cases where the category is genuinely rep G. And so everything is known here, and so one can go and check that it all fits together. The tensor products, the tensor representations on Dirichlet, since Dirichlet trivializes the bundle, one can form defects on Dirichlet across which the trivialization jumps by an element of the group. I might call those vortex lines. And they generate a semi-simple category of lines on Dirichlet that's usually called VectG. It's G-graded vector spaces with, in general, a non-commutative product that just multiplies the jumps as one goes across lines. And then we can, to get spark algebras, we lay the lines on their sides. And I think during the course of this talk, I've realized that this is the non-perturbative version of causal duality. So laying vortex lines on their sides and allowing them to end on Neumann, we get a spark algebra consisting of all elements of the group G. And we just end up with the group algebra of G. And that's consistent with representing rep G lines on Riemann. Laying Wilson lines on their sides, there are choices to be made of two vectors in the representation rho and rho dual at the ends of the Wilson line. If we sum up over all those choices, we get a spark algebra whose vector space, underlying vector space, looks like the sum over all irreducible representations of the group, rho dual tensor rho. This is all matrix elements of all irreducible representations, and there's a nice theorem that's equivalent to the algebra of functions on G with a commutative product. And representations for the algebra of functions on G is G-graded vector spaces. That's how that all fits. And then one applies. At this point, there's nothing new from any of my pictures. There's a standard Grünfeld double construction that produces the algebra in the bulk with an R matrix. And I will emphasize the nice thing again that once you have the setup with two transverse boundary conditions, you immediately know that you don't need to compute everything. It's enough to get a full Hopf algebra on one side, or you can get both of them as algebras without a coproduct. So you recover the coproduct on either side from the Hopf pairing. Which can be incredibly nice. So one way to approach, do it in a minute. I'll maybe just do it in words, because I feel like the fraction of the audience that really cares about B-twists of 3D n equals 4 theories is small. One way to approach non-perturbatively the B-twist of 3D n equals 4 gauge theory is to use other knowledge to get categories of line operators on two transverse boundary conditions. A part that I struggled with for a while is making sure there were no quantum corrections, no quantum corrections to the tensor product in these categories, which I understand now how to do with Feynman diagrams perturbatively. And there are multiple ways to get to the same answer. But will also say much easier to do this on boundaries than in the bulk. So if the goal is bulk lines, the perspective one should take is do not compute anything directly about bulk lines. Compute boundary lines first. Get them as, one way to do this is to get them as categories and represent them as modules for some algebras that are hop paired. And the hop pairing is enough to reproduce the full structure of some quantum group in the middle. I'll say what you get for 3D n equals 4 gauge theory. So for the gauge theory part, this looks like an infinite compact group version of Digraph-Witten. The spark algebra on Neumann is functions on, it's algebraic functions on the complex group. The spark algebra on Dirichlet, if we take it literally, it looks sort of like distributions on the complex group. It sort of looks like elements of the group. It's the thing whose modules are integrable modules for the enveloping algebra. And then there's a bit coming from the matter that is an exterior algebra. So if there's matter in some representation V, hypermultiplets in V times V dual. V and V dual go to opposite boundary conditions, and one gets an exterior algebra in V on one of them and an exterior algebra in V dual on the other one. And these things both fit together into some quasi-triangular Hopf algebra. It's like the quantum group controlling the bulk. The nice thing, yeah. We now have, I guess a conjecture, physical theorem that bulk line operators is the derived category of modules for this U with that R matrix. And in abelian theories, especially through a lot of work of Wenjun, we also have a Kashdan-Lustig correspondence with I think Wenjun gave a talk a month ago. So we have a Kashdan-Lustig correspondence with boundary VOA modules, and everything sort of agrees and fits.
Does this also agree with what you get by applying geometric quantization to compute the bulk lines?
Yes. But it's working. It's a little bit working.
So for bulk lines, we've known that for a while. In a Betty model in the bulk, I would write it as matrix factorizations on G times T star V, G equivariant. Matrix factorizations with a superpotential that looks like that's formed out of the moment map. That's roughly like G minus one. Matches perfectly. The underlying algebra is Kozul dual, is a partial Kozul dual to that. But now you get it as a quasi triangular Hopf algebra.
Where are the two different modal structures? The
one of them to just kind of wrap around this guy.
Cool. Why is it an E2 category? Mm-hmm. Well, if you do geometric quantization, you study the face based on its circle, it's a minus one shift, it's a bucket space, which is some kind of cotangent model. And tutor is choosing polarization. And then the product comes from the pair of hands, because you can see the Lagrangian correspondence, which you're supposed to quantize to get the two structure.
And this is just the thing that we can write this in the other polarization, where it's just matching the circle into the mod shape.
Exactly.
And so like, that
and
just.
And
the. Yeah, just has, like, I mean, just my definition.
Thanks.
Any questions? We come to Malta to talk.
I have a general question.
Yeah.
Are there instances where this enacting policy absolutely fails, like an example where it just isn't suitable?
Great question. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, for example, I was thinking
if you can't get these transverse.
Yeah, exactly. So there, I think there are lots of cases where you can't. Yeah.
So if you perturbative transverse theory, you have the upper triangular Borel, lower triangular Borel, whatever. But now perturbatively, the fiber functor lands in sheaves on G mod B mod N.
So is that a case of, oh, we can't find the right structure to like represent, or like we can't find the fiber?
You can't find fiber functors.
Prove it doesn't exist.
Well, there is a quantum group at roots of unity, so there is a fiber functor.
Okay, well, we don't
I just don't know how to build it non-perturbatively. Maybe I don't.
Yeah.
Lots of diagram fits. Not to think
more cycle. Okay, so like, you can show there's a non-existent statement.
One thing we are working on is a simple generalization of this that helps in some cases like that. When you don't have a complete fiber functor, you might still have interfaces between a complicated theory and a much simpler one. This is related to free field realizations in VOAs. But there may not be a fiber functor, but there might be nearly transverse topological interfaces that simplify your theory drastically, and then you just fail to have a fiber functor for a nearly trivial, like abelian or free theory, that you already know everything about, something like abelian Trin-Simons. And then can use a sort of a relative version of a construction like this to go up. But if you're doing like 2D sigma models to compact Calabi-Yaus and are trying to represent the category of brains in that setting, I think you're completely stuck.
This thing you're saying about like the things, representations of the integral U of G modules, there's sort of a standard mathematical way to do that, which is to take U of G and complete it with respect to like the topology where neighborhoods of zero are the kernels of integral U of G modules.
Isn't it just a jewel of functions? And you go
yeah.
Functions is a direct discrete direct sum, and you just take the same direct sum of the jewel structure. Isn't that the same thing?
It's topological. You exactly set it up so that the representations that are continuous with discrete topology are the integral ones. It's not like weak duals.
If you could elaborate after the talk, that would be great. I now have like five different versions on what.
Okay.
This thing in quotes should actually be.
Yeah.
Davide makes fun of me and calls it a metaphysical algebra. Thank you.